Chapter 7. How do I love thee? That Nyerkel. Now. Orion Fowl chose to strap himself into the emergency evac harness directly behind Holly, and spoke into her ear as she piloted the escape pod through the glacial wormhole excavated by the rogue probe. Having a person talk directly into one's ear is irritating at the best of times, but when that person is spouting romantic nonsense while the owner of the ear is attempting to wrestle with the controls of a 20-year-old escape pod in a high-speed pursuit, then it's a little more than annoying. It's dangerously distracting. Holly scrubbed the porthole with the sleeve of her suit. Outside, a single nosebeam picked out the wormhole's path. Straight, she thought. At least it's straight. How do I love thee? Wondered Orion. Let me see. I love thee passionately and eternally. Obviously, eternally. That goes without saying. Holly blinked sweat from her eyes. Is he serious? She called over her shoulder to Foley. Oh, absolutely, said the centaur, his voice juddering along with the pod's motion. If he asks you to look for birthmarks, say no immediately.
Oh, I would never, Orion assured her. Ladies don't look for birthmarks. That is work for jolly fellows like the goodly beast and myself. Ladies like Miss Short do enough by simply existing. They exude beauty, and that is enough.
I am not exuding anything, said Holly through gritted teeth. Orion tapped her shoulder.
I beg to differ. You're exuding right now. A wonderful aura. It's pastel blue with little dolphins.
Holly gripped the wheel tightly. I'm going to be sick. Did he just say pastel blue? And dolphins, little ones, said Foley, happy enough to be distracted from the fact that they were now chasing the probe that had blown up their shuttle, which was a bit like a mouse chasing a cat, a giant mutant cat with laser eyes and a belly full of smaller, spiteful cats. Be quiet, goodly beast. Be quiet, both of you. Holly could not afford to be distracted, so to shut out the babbling Orion, she talked herself through what she was doing, recording it all on the ship's log. Still going through the ice, an incredibly thick vein. No radar or sonar, just following the lights. The light show on display through the porthole was both eerie and colourful. The probe's engines shot beams along the carved ice, sending rainbows flickering across the flat plains. Holly was sure she saw an entire school of whales, preserved in the glacier, and maybe some kind of enormous sea reptile. The probe maintains its course. A diagonal descent. We are transitioning from ice to rock now, with no discernible delay. It was true. The increased density seemed to have no effect on the probe's laser cutters. Foley could not resist a smug comment.
I know how to build 'em, he said.
But not how to control 'em, Holly rejoined.
You have displeased the princess, cried Orion, thrashing in his harness. Were it not for these accursed bonds!
You would be dead, said Foley, completing the sentence for him.
Good point,
Orion conceded.
And the princess is calm now, so no harm done, goodly fellow. I must mind my knight's temper. Sometimes I rush to battle.
Holly's ears itched, which was purely from stress, she knew, but that didn't stop them itching.
We need to cure Artemis, she said, wishing for a free hand to scratch. I can't take much more of this.
The rock face flashed by outside in a confusing meld of greys and deep blue. Ash, pulverized stone, and chunks of debris spiraled down the tunnel wall, further impairing Holly's vision. She checked the escape pod's communication station without much hope.
Nothing. No contact with Haven. We're still blocked.
The probe must have seen us by now. Why no aggressive action? Foley squirmed in a harness built for two-legged creatures.
Oh, yes. Why no aggressive action? How I long for aggressive action. I live for aggressive action,
thundered Orion squeakily, which was unusual.
Oh, how I pray that dragon will turn around that I may smite it.
Smite it with what? Wondered Foley.
Your secret birthmark. Don't you mock my birthmark, which I may or may not have. Shut up, both of you, snapped Holly. The light's changed. Something is coming.
Foley smooshed his cheek against the rear porthole.
Ah, yes, I expected that.
What did you expect?
Well, we must be below sea level by now, so what's coming would be a great big bit of ocean. Now, we'll see just how well I did design that probe.
The light bouncing off the tunnel wall had suddenly become dull and flickering, and a huge booming whoomph vibrated through the pod's walls. Even Orion was struck dumb as a solid tube of water surged upwards towards them. Holly knew from her training that she should relax her muscles and ride the impact, but every cell in her body wanted to tense up before contact. "Keep the nose straight," she told herself. "Cut through the surface. Underneath is calm." The water closed around them like a malevolent fist and shook the pod, battering its occupants. Everything that was not bolted down became a missile. A toolbox gave Foley a nasty welt, and Orion's forehead was punctured by a fork that left tiny wounds where it had struck. Holly swore like a sailor as she battled to keep the nose down, fighting the fury of nature, talking to the pod as though it were an unbroken bronco. A rivet pinged from its housing and ricocheted around the cabin, knocking a sliver from the viewscreen, sending a web of shining cracks crackling across the glass. Holly winced. "Darn it! Not good! Not good!" Orion placed a hand on her shoulder. "At least we take the great adventure together, eh, maiden?" "Not just yet, we don't," Holly said, levelling out the rear flaps and punching the craft through the turmoil into the wide, calm ocean. The viewscreen held for the moment, and Holly glared through it, searching for the probe's telltale engine glare. For several moments, she saw nothing out of place in the Atlantic Ocean, but then, south-southwest, down 10 fathoms or so, she noticed 4 glowing blue disks.
"There!" she cried. "I see it!"
"Shouldn't we head for the nearest shuttle port?" wondered Foley. "Try to make contact with Haven?"
"No," replied Holly. "We need to maintain a visual and try to work out where this thing's going. If we lose it, then thanks to your stealth ore, it's lost, with plenty of water to hide in."
"That's another jibe, young lady," said Foley sulkily. "Don't think I'm not counting."
"Counting?" said Orion. "Artemis used to do that."
"I wish we had Artemis now," said Holly grimly. 5s and all. He would know what to do."
Orion pouted. "But you have me. I can help."
"Let me guess.
Bivouac?"
Orion's face was so desolate that Holly relented. "Okay, listen, Orion, if you really want to help, keep an eye on the comms screen. If we get a signal, let me know."
"I shall not fail you, fair maiden," vowed Orion. "This comms screen is now my holy grail. I shall wish a signal from its cold heart of wire and capacitors."
Foley was about to interject and explain how the communication screen had neither wires nor capacitors, but when he saw the poisonous look Holly was shooting him, the centaur decided to keep his mouth closed. "And you," said Holly in a tone to match her look, "try to figure out how the great Foley has circumvented so completely. And maybe then we can get control of that probe before anyone else gets hurt."
"That's another jibe," thought Foley, but he was wise enough not to say this aloud.
Down and down they went, into deeper and darker blue. The probe stuck rigidly to its course, turning aside for neither rock nor reef, seemingly unaware of the tiny escape pod on its tail.
"They must see us," thought Holly, pushing the pod to its limits just to keep up.
But if the probe had spotted them, it gave no sign, just ploughed through the ocean at a constant rate of knots, unswervingly drawing closer to its goal, wherever that was. Holly had a thought.
"Foley, you have a communicator, don't you?"
The centaur was sweating in the oxygen-depleted atmosphere, light blue shirt now mostly dark blue.
"Of course I do. I already checked for a signal. Nothing."
"I know, but what kind of mini-programs do you have on there? Anything for navigation?" Foley pulled out his phone and scrolled through the mini-programs.
"I do have a nav MIPI. All self-contained, no signal needed."
The centaur did not need to be told what to do. He unstrapped himself from the harness and laid his phone on an omnisensor on the dash. Its screen was instantly displayed on a small screen in the porthole. A 3D compass appeared and spent a few seconds plotting the pod's movements, which Holly made sure were mirroring the probe's course.
"Okay," said the centaur. "We're locked in."
"I designed this MEPI, by the way. I earn more from this little wonder than all my LEP work.
Just tell me."
Foley dragged a little ship icon along its straight line on the screen until it reached the ocean floor. There was a pulsing red circle at the point of impact.
"That circle is pretty," said Orion.
"Not for long," said Foley, paling.
Holly took her eyes off the probe for half a second. "Tell me, Foley, what's down there?" The centaur suddenly felt the full weight of his responsibility, something he had been repressing since his probe's attack.
"Atlantis. My God, Holly, the probe is headed directly for Atlantis."
Holly's eyes swiveled back to the 4 circles of light. Can it break through the dome?
That's not what it was designed to do. Holly gave him a moment to think about what he had just said.
Okay, I admit it's doing a lot of things it wasn't designed to do.
Well then. Foley made a few calculations on the screen, calculations that Artemis might have understood had he been present.
It's possible, he said. Nothing of the probe would remain intact. But at this speed, it might put a crack in the dome.
Holly coaxed a little more speed from the pod.
We need to warn Atlantis. Orion, do we have anything on the communications?
The pod's human passenger looked up from the screen.
Not a twitter, Princess. But this light is flashing rather urgently. Does it have a special significance?
Foley peered over his shoulder.
The hull must have been breached in the tunnel. We're running out of oxygen.
For a second, Holly's shoulders slumped.
It doesn't matter. We keep going.
Foley cupped both hooves around his cranium, holding in the thoughts.
No. Now we try to get outside the probe's jamming corona. We should run for the surface.
What if it changes course?
Then it won't hit Atlantis and nobody will drown or be crushed. And even if it does swing back round, they'll be ready for it.
It went against Holly's instincts to run. I feel like we're deserting those people down there. Foley pointed at the screen.
At that speed, the probe will reach Atlantis in 3 hours. We'll run out of oxygen in 5 minutes. We'll be unconscious in 6, dead in 12, and no use to anybody.
I feel a little dizzy, said Orion, but also wonderfully elated. I feel I'm on the verge of finding a rhyme for the word orange.
Oxygen deprivation, said Foley. Or perhaps it's just him.
Holly closed down the throttle.
Could we make it?
Foley tapped out a complicated equation.
If we go in the opposite direction right now, maybe. If whoever is doing this has somehow boosted the jammer, then no.
Maybe is the best you can do? Foley nodded wearily.
The absolute best.
Holly swung the pod round with 3 deft manoeuvres.
Best odds I've had all day, she said.
It was a race now, but an unusual one where the competitors were running away from each other. The goal was simple. Now that they knew where the probe was headed, Holly had 6 minutes to pilot the pod out of the jamming corona. Also, it would be nice to have some oxygen to breathe. Luckily, the probe was on a steep descent, so the pod should go on a steep ascent. If they managed to break the surface before 6 minutes ran out, then brilliant. They'd broadcast until Haven picked up the signal. If not, then the pod wasn't equipped with automatic pilot or broadcast facilities, so the probe would be on top of Atlantis security towers before they even noticed it. And another little negative was that they would be dead.
It's funny, thought Holly. I don't think my heart rate is up that much. These life or death situations have become almost normal for me ever since meeting Artemis Fowl.
She glanced sideways at the romantic who was wearing Artemis's face, and he caught the look.
Penny for your thoughts, Princess, though they are worth the king's ransom.
I was wishing that you would go away, said Holly bluntly,
and return Artemis to us. We need him.
Orion hummed.
That thought is not as valuable as I had imagined.
Why do you want Artemis back? He's nasty and mean to everyone.
Because Artemis could get us out of this alive and save the people of Haven and possibly find out who murdered all those LEP officers.
I grant you that, said Orion, miffed, but his sonnets are heartless, and that opera house he designed was totally self-indulgent.
Yep, that's what we need now, Foley chimed in. Opera house designing skills.
Oh, yes, traitorous steed, said Orion testily. Probe designing skills would be much more useful.
Holly sounded a quick burst on the klaxon for attention.
Excuse me, gentlemen, all this arguing is consuming oxygen, so could we all please be quiet?
Is that a command, beloved?
Yes, whispered Holly ominously. It is.
Very well. Then quiet it shall be. I would rather cut out my own tongue than utter one more word. I would sooner behead myself with a butter knife than speak a single...
Holly gave in to a baser instinct and jabbed Orion in the solar plexus. That was wrong, she thought to herself as the boy drooped in his harness, gasping for breath. I'm going to feel guilty about that later. If there was a later. There was plenty of power in the fuel block, just no air in the tanks, and no recycling facility to scrub the carbon dioxide from the exhaled air. The pod was supposed to be a short-term option only. It hadn't been designed for actual missions. The hull could crack under the pressure of steep ascent long before the fuel ran out.
So many ways to die, thought Holly. Eventually one of them is going to get us.
The digital depth gauge was spinning backwards from 10,000 meters.
They were in an Atlantic trench, never before seen by human eyes. Shoals of strange luminous fish swarmed around them, easily keeping pace, butting the hull with the fleshy glowing bulbs in their transparent bellies. Then the light changed and the fish were gone, darting away so quickly it was as though they had simply dematerialized. In their place were seals and whales and fish like silver arrowheads. A chunk of blue ice rolled past, and Holly saw her mother's face in its planes and shadows. Oxygen deprivation, she told herself. That's all it is. How long? She asked Foley. The centaur checked the oxygen levels. Based on three conscious beings, nervous conscious beings, I might add, rapidly consuming the air, we're going to be short a minute or two. You said we could make it. The hole in the tank is expanding. Holly beat her fist on the dash. Darn it, Foley! Why does it always have to be so hard? Foley spoke calmly. Holly, my friend, you know what you have to do. No, Foley, I don't. Yes, you do. Holly did know. There were three conscious people breathing hard. Foley alone took in more oxygen than a bull troll. It only took one person to steer the ship and send the message. It was a tough choice, but there was no time to agonize over it. She felt for a squat metal cylinder in one of the rings on her belt and pulled it out. "What's that, sweetness?" asked Orion, who had just recovered from the belly jab. Holly answered the question with one of her own. "Would you do anything for me, Orion?" The boy's face seemed to light up. "Of course, absolutely anything. Close your eyes and count to 10." Orion was disappointed. "What? No tasks, not even a dragon to slay. Close your eyes if you love me." Orion did so immediately, and Holly prodded him in the neck with a battery-powered shocker. The electrocuted boy slumped in the harness, two electrode burns smoking gently on his neck. "Nicely done," said Foley nervously. "A knot in the neck for me, if you don't mind." Holly checked the shocker. "Don't worry, I only had enough charge for one." Foley could not suppress a sigh of relief, and when he glanced guiltily across at Orion, knowing that really he should be the unconscious one, Holly hit him in the flank with the second charge. Foley did not even have time to think, "You sneaky elf," before slumping in the corner. "Sorry, guys," said Holly, then made a silent vow not to speak again until it was time to send the message. The pod powered towards the surface, its prow slicing through the water. Holly steered through a vast underwater canyon, which had developed its own ecology, completely safe from human exploitation. She saw huge undulating eels that could crush a bus, strange crabs with glowing shells, and some kind of two-legged creature that disappeared into a crevice before she could get a proper look at it. She took the most direct line she could through the canyon, finding a rock chimney that allowed her to exit into open sea. There was still nothing on the communications array, solidly blocked. She needed to get further away. "I could really do with some warlock magic right now," Holly thought. "If number one were here, he could wiggle his runes and turn carbon dioxide into oxygen." Water, fish, and bubbles flashed past the window. And could that be a shaft of light from the surface? Had the craft reached the photic zone? Holly tried the radio again. She heard static this time, but maybe with some chatter inside it. "Good," she thought, but her head was fuzzy. "Did I imagine that?" "Now you heard it all right," said the unconscious Foley. "Did I ever tell you about my kids?" Oxygen deprivation. That's all it was. "Why did you shoot me, sweetness?" wondered passed out Orion. "Did I displease you?" "It's too late. Too late." Holly was shaking now. She filled her lungs, but was not satisfied with the foul air. The pod walls became suddenly concave, bending in to crush her. "It's not happening!" she called, breaking her vow of silence. She checked the comms again. Some signal now. There were definitely words among the static. Enough to transmit? One way to find out. Holly tapped through her options on the dashboard readout and selected transmit, only to be informed that the external antenna was not available. The computer advised her to check the connection. Holly pressed her face to the starboard and saw that the connection was pretty well defunct, as the entire thing had been knocked out of its housing by one impact or another. Why doesn't this tug-bucket Stone Age piece of junk have an internal antenna? Even glooping phones have internal antenna. Phones! Of course! Holly punched the harness release button on her chest and dropped to her knees. She slid along the deck, moving towards Foley. It smells bad down here. Stale air.
For a second, one of the handrails grew a snake's hand and hissed at her.
Your time is running out, it said. Your odds are short.
Short. Don't listen to that snake, said Foley, without moving his lips. He's just bitter because his soul is stuck in a handrail, because of some stuff that happened in a previous life.
I still love you, said sleeping Orion, breathing slow and steady, using hardly any oxygen.
I am really going insane this time, thought Holly.
Holly pulled herself along Foley's frame, reaching into his shirt pocket for his phone. The Centaur never went anywhere without his precious phone, and was proud of its modified clunkiness.
I love that phone, said Foley proudly. Over 500 meepees. All my own design. I did a nice one called Offspring. Say you find the love of your life. All you need to do is take a photo of you and your beloved, and Offspring will show you what your potential kids will look like.
Fascinating. I hope we get to talk about it for real sometime. The phone was switched on, so there was no need for a password. Although knowing Foley, as she did, Holly supposed that his password would be some version of his own name. His screen was a crazy jumble of meepees that probably made sense if you were a Centaur. The problem with all these applications is that sometimes a person just wants to make a quick call. Where's the phone icon? Then the icons started waving at her.
Pick me, they chorused. Over here.
That's not a hallucination, said passed out Foley proudly. Those little guys are animated.
Phone! Holly shouted into the communicator's microphone, hoping for voice control. To her relief, a blurry, old-fashioned cone phone icon expanded to fill the screen.
It's not actually blurry. My eyesight's fading.
Call Police Plaza, she ordered the icon.
The phone ticked for a minute, then asked,
Do you wish to call Phil's Pizza?
No, call Police Plaza.
The water rushing by was definitely more azure now, shot through with bubbles and bending streaks of light.
Do you wish to call Police Plaza?
Yes, gasped Holly. Yes, I do.
There was more jostling as the pod passed through the surface disturbance and was flipped by the waves.
Connecting you with Police Plaza.
The phone hummed gently as it tried to connect, then said in a comically sad voice,
Boo-hoo! You don't have a strong enough signal. Would you like to record a message for me to send just as soon as the signal is strong enough?
Yes, croaked Holly.
Did you say yikes? Because yikes is not an appropriate response in this situation.
Holly composed herself.
Yes, I would like to compose a message.
Great, said the phone brightly. Start recording after the bell. And remember, good manners don't cost anything, so always introduce yourself and say goodbye.
Say goodbye, thought Holly. Funny.
After the phone rang, Holly recorded a concise message, containing as few coughs and splutters as possible, identifying herself as the phone had suggested, and also identifying the threat heading towards Atlantis. Almost as soon as she had finished, Holly collapsed on her back, flopping weakly, like a stranded fish. There were spots before her eyes, which grew larger and became pale circles, crowding together, obscuring her vision. She did not see the colours outside the porthole change from blue to green to the dull, pearlescent white of a northern sky. She did not hear the pressure vents pop, or feel cool air flooding the cabin. And Captain Holly Short did not know that 15 minutes after the pod surfaced, her message to Police Plaza would finally be transmitted and be acted upon almost immediately. It would have been acted upon immediately had not the sprite on the switchboard, a certain Chicks Verbal, initially believed that the message was a prank call from his poker buddy, Cruz, made to make fun of his nasally voice. Chicks only decided to pass the message on to Commander Trouble Kelp when it occurred to him that there could be a career downside to ignoring the warning that could have saved Atlantis. Trouble Kelp held an emergency video conference with the People's Council, and an evacuation was immediately approved. The Deeps, Atlantis. Now. Turnbull Root was busy, pretending to be busy, working on his model of the Nostremius Aquanaut, so that he would appear all the more innocent when they came to get him, which he was certain they would very shortly. Pretending to be busy takes more energy than simply being busy, Turnbull realized. and this cheered him tremendously, as it was a witty observation, and just the kind of thing that his eventual biographers would pick up on. But witty observations must now take a back seat to the plan. After all, witty observations would be far more enjoyable when he had someone else besides Vishpi to listen to them. Leonore adored his little comments, and often wrote them in her diary. Turnbull's eyes lost their focus, and his hands froze in space as he remembered their first summer together on that beautiful island in the Pacific. She, boyish in her vest and jodhpurs, he, handsome and rakish, in his LEP dress jacket.
"This can never work, Captain. How can it possibly work? I am human, after all, and you are most certainly not."
And quick as a flash, she had taken her hands in his and said,
"Love can break down any barriers. Love and magic."
That was when he had made her love him. Leonore had jumped a little, but not removed her hands.
"I felt a spark, Turnbull," she had said.
He joked, "I felt it too," then explained. "Static electricity, that always happens to me."
Leonore believed it, and fell for her captain.
"She would have loved me soon enough anyway," thought Turnbull crossly. "I simply hurried the process."
But he knew in his heart that he had bolstered Leonore's emotions with magic, and now that she was so far beyond her natural end, his hold on her was slipping.
"Without magic, will she love me as I love her?"
He wondered 1,000 times a day, and knew that he was terrified to find out. To keep his vital signs steady, Turnbull turned his thoughts once more to his thrall, Mr. Vishpi. Vishpi was undeniably a repulsive dolt, and yet Turnbull Root had a soft spot for the lad, and would perhaps even decide to let him live when this was all over, or at least kill him quickly. Of all the great schemes and impossible heists that Turnbull had been involved in as a crooked cop, fugitive, or inmate, the simple-sounding act of turning Vishpi had been the most ambitious. It had required perfect timing, audacity, and months of grooming. Turnbull often thought of this plan, which he had set into motion almost 4 years previously. It wasn't as if Vishpi were a human with an already treacherous and self-serving nature. Vishpi was a fairy, and most fairies, with the exception of goblins, were just not inclined towards the criminal life. Common lawbreakers, like that Diggum's character, were common enough, but intelligent, foresighted criminals were rare. Vishpi's downfall was that he was a moaner. And as the months had rolled by, he gradually let down his guard with Turnbull Root, and told him all about his demotion following Mulch Diggums's escape. He also expressed a bitterness towards the LEP for the reprimand, and wished he could do something to get back at them. Turnbull saw his chance, his first real chance of escape since his arrest. He formulated a plan to recruit Vishpi. The first stage was to feign sympathy for the water elf, whereas in reality, had he been in charge, he would have flushed him out of an airlock for his performance in the Diggums episode.
"I so enjoy our chats," he had said. "How I wish we could talk more freely."
Vishpi had clammed up immediately, remembering that every word was on tape. On his next visit, Vishpi had entered with a smug tilt to his fishy head, and Turnbull knew his plan would succeed.
"I switched off your mic," the prison warder had said. "Now we can talk about whatever we like."
And then Turnbull knew that he had him. All it would take was a little Turnbull Root magic to make Vishpi his slave. Except that Turnbull Root didn't have magic. That was the one irrevocable price that criminals paid. Loss of magic. Forever. This was one forfeit that there was no coming back from, and exiled criminals had been trying for centuries. They bought potions, tried spells, chanted in the moonlight, slept upside down, bathed in centaur dung. Nothing worked. Once you had broken the fairy rules, your magic was gone. It was partly a psychological thing, but mostly it was the result of age-old warlock hexes that successive administrations did not feel like unlocking. This denial of his basic fairy rights had always irked Turnbull. And during his years as a fugitive, he had spent a fortune on dozens of witch doctors and quacks who all claimed they could have him running hot, brimful of magic, if only he would take this potion or recite that spell backwards in the dead of night while holding a grumpy frog. Nothing worked. Nothing. Until, a century ago, Turnbull found an exiled sprite living in Ho Chi Minh City, who had somehow managed to maintain a tiny spark of power, just enough to remove the occasional wart. for a huge price, which Turnbull would have paid a million times over, she revealed her secret.
Man like loot and I swine. It won't bring the sweet magic back, Captain, but each time you partake of these two, they'll give you a spark. One hot spark at a time, and that is all. Use this little trick wisely, my Captain. Oh, the spark won't be there when you most need it.
This pearl from an alcoholic sprite. It was a trick he'd used in the past, but not since his arrest, until now. And so for his birthday that year, Turnbull had requested a dinner of pufferfish with fofo berries and mandrake shavings, followed by a carafe of rice wine and Sim coffee. This request was accompanied by the revelation of the whereabouts of a notorious group of arms smugglers, which would be quite a feather in the warden's cap. Tarpon Vindhyaya agreed to the request. When Vishpi arrived with the meal, Turnbull invited him to stay and talk, and while they chatted, Turnbull picked at his meal, eating only the mandrake shavings and drinking only the wine, all the time subtly reinforcing Vishpi's opinion of the LEP.
"Yes, my dear Vishpi, they are unfeeling louts. I mean, what were you to do? That thug Diggums left you no option but to flee."
And when the moment was right, when Turnbull felt a single spark of magic coalesce in his gut, he rested his hand lightly on Vishpi's shoulder, allowing his little finger to touch the water elf's bare neck. Usually neck touching is no big deal. Wars have rarely been fought over a neck touch, but this touch was malicious. For on the pad of his finger, Turnbull had painted in his own blood a black magic thrall rune. Turnbull was a great believer in runes. Ideally, for maximum effectiveness, the person having the spell cast on them would be spread-eagled on a granite plinth, doused in oil fermented from the tears of unicorns and tattooed from head to foot with symbols, and then given at least 3 minutes of magic full in the face. But you make do with what you have, and hope for the best. So Turnbull touched Vishpi on the neck, and transferred his single spark of magic through the contact. Vishpi slapped his neck as if stung.
"Oh, hey, what was that?"
"I felt a spark, Turnbull."
Turnbull quickly withdrew his hand.
"Static electricity. That always happens around me. My mother was afraid to kiss me. Here, Vishpi, have some of this wine, to make up for the shock."
Vishpi eyed the contents of the carafe greedily. Alcoholic beverages were not usually allowed in the prison, as with prolonged use it causes the magical receptors to atrophy. But some fairies, much like humans, cannot resist what is bad for them.
"I'm your fairy," he said,
eagerly accepting a cup.
"Yes," Turnbull thought. "Yes, you are now."
Turnbull knew it would work. It had before. On stronger minds than Vishpi's. And so Vishpi found that he could never say no to Turnbull Root. It started out with simple, harmless requests. An extra blanket, some reading material not in the prison system. But soon Vishpi found himself inextricably bound up in Turnbull's escape plans. And what was more, he didn't seem to mind being involved. It seemed to be the sensible thing to do. Over the following 4 years, Vishpi had gone from guard to accomplice. He had made contact with several inmates who were still loyal to Turnbull and prepared them for the great escape. He made several raids on what was then Cowboy Laboratories and used his security code to access their sensitive recycling plant, where he found, among other things, the scrambler wafer and the infinitely more valuable control orb for the Mars probe. Somewhere in the back of his mind, Vishpi knew that eventually someone would find out about these thefts, but he couldn't seem to make himself care. Most of what he had found at Cowboy Labs was of absolutely no use or was too far gone to be fixed, but the control orb needed only a slight descaling and the insertion of a new omnisensor. These were such simple tasks that he had Vishpi do them at home, with a little webcam supervision, naturally. Once he had a working original control orb in his possession, it was a relatively simple matter for Turnbull to sync with the Mars probe before takeoff and begin the arduous task of reprogramming its mission parameters. This was not a task he could complete before the spacecraft actually left the Earth, but off the top of his head, he could think of a dozen ways a rogue spaceship might prove useful, but not on Mars.
"Mars? Oh, no, no, Leonore. That's too far away and of no use to me. Let's wait until it takes off on its mission, and then turn this big fellow around.
His original plan for the probe had been simplicity itself. Use it as a very big and very loud distraction on its return from Mars. But as Leonore's communications became terser and somehow colder, Turnbull realized that he would have to accelerate his schedule and refine his plot. It was vital that he escape, but it was even more important that he strengthen his hold over Leonore before her humanity completely reasserted itself. Her aging was now so rapid that it would take some very special magic to reverse it. And there was only one place to get such magic. If Julius had been alive, Turnbull would have worried about his little brother tumbling to his deception. But even with Julius gone, there was still the entire LEP to worry about. He needed to damage the Force, cut off the head of the snake, and maybe its tail too. And so Turnbull monitored Warden Vinyaya's communications, using the password Vishby had stolen for him. He was especially interested in the calls to the Warden's sister, Commander Raina Vinyaya of the LEP. The snake's head. Commander Vinyaya was a hard fairy to kill, especially if your weapon was a blunt instrument in space, and the commander seemed reluctant to go topside where she was vulnerable. And then, only last month, she had made a video call to her brother, informing him in giddy tones that she would never allow anyone else to hear of her trip to Iceland to meet the mudwhelp, Artemis Fowl. Apparently the boy was planning to save the world. The infamous Artemis Fowl, Commander Vinyaya and Holly Short too, together in one place. Perfect.
Turnbull activated his control orb and fed an entirely new set of mission parameters to the Mars probe, parameters which the probe never even questioned because they came from its own orb. To paraphrase, come back to Earth and crush the commander and as many of her elite team as possible. Crush them, then burn them, then electrocute the cinders. What fun! Then there was Artemis Fowl. He had heard of the boy, and by all accounts this particular human was a little brighter than most. Better to study up a little, just in case the human had a little treachery planned himself. Turnbull used the Warden's code to access the LEP surveillance feed from more than 200 camera bugs planted in Fowl Manor, and found to his utter delight that Artemis Fowl seemed to be developing Atlantis complex.
Atlantis is the magic word for this mission, he thought.
Turnbull was equally concerned about the Mud Boy's gigantic bodyguard, who seemed just the kind of person to hunt down and kill his master's murderer.
The famous butler, the man who took down a troll.
Luckily, Artemis himself took Butler out of play when his paranoia flared up, and he invented a reason to send the bodyguard to Mexico. Even though it complicated his plans a little, Turnbull decided to have a little fun with the butlers, just to cut off any vengeful loose ends.
I know you would not approve of all these deaths, Leonore, Turnbull thought as he sat at his computer, sending instructions through to Vishby's terminal. But they are necessary if we are to be together forever. Those people are unimportant compared to our eternal love, and you will never know the price of our happiness. All you will know is that we are reunited.
But in truth, Turnbull knew that he enjoyed all the machinations tremendously, and was almost sorry to send the kill orders. Almost, but not quite. Even better than scheming would be all the time to be spent with Leonore, and it had been too long since he had seen his wife's beautiful face. So he'd sent the kill orders to the probe and loaded up on mandrake and rice wine. Luckily, it took only the barest spark of magic to mesmerize humans.
Because they are weak-willed and stupid, but funny, like monkeys.
When Vishby arrived on that final day in prison, Turnbull was sitting on his hands, trying hard to contain his excitement.
"Ah, Mr. Vishby," he said when the door dissolved. "You're early. Is there some irregularity I should be concerned about?"
Vishby's impassive fish face was a little more emotional than usual.
"The Warden's sister is dead. Commander Vinyaya and a whole shuttle of LEP blown apart. Did we do that?"
Turnbull licked the blood rune on his finger.
Whether we did or not is unimportant. You shouldn't be concerned.
Vishby absently fingered his neck, where a faint outline of the rune still glowed.
I am not concerned. Why should I be? It was nothing to do with us.
Good. Fabulous. I imagine we have bigger fish to fry.
Vishby flinched at the fish reference.
Oh, oops. Sorry, Mr. Wishby. I should be more sensitive. Come now, tell me what news.
Wishby flapped his gills for a moment, getting the sentences together in his head. Captain Root did not like stammering.
There's a space probe heading directly for Atlantis, so we have to evacuate the city. It's likely that the craft won't actually penetrate the dome, but the Council can't take the chance. I've been called up to pilot the shuttle, and you're one of my, passengers.
Turnbull sighed, disappointed.
Oh, but passengers, really?
Wishby rolled his eyes.
Sorry, Captain. Passengers, of course, one of my passengers.
It's so unprofessional, the stammering.
I know, said Wishby. I'm working on it. I bought one of those, audio books. I'm nervous now.
Turnbull decided to go easy on Wishby. There would be plenty of time for discipline later, when he was killing the water elf. The ultimate punishment.
It's only natural, he said magnanimously. First day back in the pilot's chair, then there's this mysterious probe, plus you have to transport all us dangerous prisoners.
Wishby seemed even more nervous.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is, I don't want to do this, Turnbull, but...
But you have to cuff me, completed Turnbull. Of course, I understand completely.
He thrust out his hands with wrists upturned.
It's not as if you have to fasten the cuffs, is it?
Wishby blinked and touched his neck.
Oh, no, why would I fasten them? That would be barbaric.
The water elf laid a set of standard ultralight plastic polymer cuffs across Turnbull's wrist.
Comfy?
He asked. Again, Turnbull was feeling generous.
I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. You concentrate on the shuttle.
Thanks, Captain. This is a big day for me.
As Wishby dissolved the door, Turnbull was struck by how the guard's subconscious dealt with betraying all that he believed in. Wishby simply pretended that everything was as it should be, until the moment when it was not. The water elf somehow managed to keep two lives running simultaneously side by side.
Amazing what a person will do to avoid guilt, thought Turnbull,
following Wishby through the doorway and taking his first breath of free recycled air in years. Atlantis was small by human standards. With barely 10,000 residents, it wouldn't even qualify as a city to the Mudmen, but to the fairies, it was their second centre of government and culture, the first being the capital, Haven City. There was a growing lobby to demolish Atlantis altogether, as the upkeep cost a fortune in taxpayers' money, and it was only a matter of time before the humans sank one of their submarine drones in the right spot and got a shot of the dome. But the budget for such a massive relocation and demolition project was so huge that continued maintenance always seemed the more attractive option to the politicians. It was more expensive in the long term, but the politicians reasoned that by the time the long term came around, somebody else would be in office. Wishby led Turnbull Root along a corridor tube with perspex walling, through which he could see dozens of crafts queuing at various dome pressure lock toll gates, waiting to swipe their credit chips for exit. There didn't seem to be any panic. And why would there be? The Atlanteans had been preparing for a dome breach ever since the last one, more than 8,000 years ago, when an asteroid had superheated a 2-mile-long tube of ocean before spending its last gasp of energy knocking a crunchball-sized chunk out of the dome, which in those days had not been shatterproof. In less than an hour, the entire city had been submerged with more than 5,000 casualties. It had taken 100 years or so to build the new Atlantis, on top of the foundation supplied by the ruins of the old Atlantis, and this time an evacuation strategy had featured large in the city's blueprints. All of which meant that in case of emergency, every male, female, and child fairy could be out of the city in less than an hour. Drills were held every week, and in nursery school, the first rhyme every student learned was, "The blue dome protects our home. If it should crack, prepare for evac."
Turnbull Root recalled this ditty as he followed Wishby along the corridor.
Crack? Evac? What kind of rhyme was that? Evac wasn't even a real word, just a military contraction, exactly the kind of word Julius might have used. I'm so glad Leonore never had to endure meeting my boorish brother. If she had, no amount of magical persuasion could have enticed her to marry me.
A part of Turnbull knew that he kept Leonore away from the people in general, because a 10-minute conversation with any fairy under the world would have shown Leonore that her husband was not quite the noble revolutionary that he pretended to be. Luckily, this was a part of himself that Turnbull had become quite adept at ignoring. Other prisoners were shambling from their cells across narrow bridges onto the main walkway. Each was shackled and dressed in the lime-green Deep's prison jumpsuit. Most were laying on the bravado, rolling swaggers and obvious sneers. But Turnbull knew from experience that it was the ones with the placid gazes you had to worry about. Those ones were beyond caring.
"Come on now, convicts!"
called a particularly Cro-Magnon-looking jumbo pixie, a breed that sometimes popped up in Atlantis due to the pressurized environment.
"Keep moving there! Don't make me buzz you!"
"At least I'm wearing my full dress uniform," thought Turnbull, ignoring the guard. But he did not feel much consoled. Uniform or no, he was being paraded down this walkway like a common prisoner. He soothed himself with the decision that he would definitely kill Vishby as soon as possible and maybe send an email to Lita, congratulating Vishby's sweetheart on her new single status. She would probably be delighted. Vishby raised a fist, bringing the procession to a halt at an intersection. The prisoners were forced to wait like cattle, while a large metal cube, secured with titanium bands, was floated past them on a hover trolley.
"Opal Cowboy," explained Vishby. "She's so dangerous, they're not even letting her out of her cell."
Turnbull bristled. "Opal Cowboy." People down here spent their days gossiping about Opal Cowboy. The current rumor was that there was another Opal Cowboy around somewhere who had come out of the past to rescue herself in the present. People might get more done if they stopped obsessing over Opal Blooming Cowboy. If anyone should be concerned about Cowboy, it was him. After all, she had murdered his little brother. Then again, better not. Dwelling on the past could cause his ulcer to return. It took the cube an age to float by, and Turnbull counted three doors on the side.
"Three doors. My cell has a single door. Why does Cowboy need a cell so big that it has three doors?"
It didn't matter. He would be out of here soon enough, and then he could treat himself like royalty.
"Leonore and I shall return to the island where we first met so dramatically."
As soon as the intersection was clear, Vishby led them on towards their shuttle bay. Through the clear plastic, Turnbull noticed crowds of civilians walking briskly, but without apparent panic, towards their own rescue pods. On the upper levels, groups of Atlantis's more affluent citizens strolled to private evacuation shuttles that probably cost more than Turnbull could steal in a week.
"Ruffles are back in," Turnbull noted with some pleasure. "I knew it."
The corridor opened out into a loading bay where groups of prisoners were waiting impatiently by airlocks, which opened directly onto the sea.
"This is all so unnecessary," said Vishby. "The water cannons are going to blast this probe thing to smithereens. We'll all be back here in a few minutes."
"Not all of us," thought Turnbull, not bothering to conceal a smile. "Some of us are never coming back."
And he knew in that instant that it was true. Even if his plan failed, he was never coming back here. One way or another, Turnbull Root would be free. Vishby beeped the shuttle door with his keys, and the manacled prisoners filed inside. Once they were seated, Vishby activated carnival ride-style safety bars, which also acted as very effective restraints. The convicts were pinned to their seats and still cuffed, totally helpless.
"You got them, Vishby?"
asked the Cro-Magnon pixie.
"Yes, I got them, and the name's Vishby."
Turnbull smirked. Office bullying, another reason he had been able to turn Vishby so easily.
"That's what I said! Frisbee! Now why don't you pilot this bucket out of here and let me keep watch on these scary convicts?"
Vishby bristled.
"Just you wait a minute."
Turnbull Root did not have time for a showdown.
"That's an excellent idea, Mr. Vishby. You put that pilot's license to good use and let your colleague here watch over us scary convicts."
Vishby touched his neck.
"Sure, why not? I should get us out of here like I'm supposed to."
"Exactly. You know it makes sense."
"Go on, fish boy,"
scoffed the big guard, whose name tag had been altered to read K-Max.
"Do what the convict tells you."
Vishby sat at the controls and ran a brisk pre-launch, whistling softly through his gills to shut out K-Max's jibes.
"This K-Max fellow doesn't realize how much trouble he's in," thought Turnbull, the idea pleasing him tremendously. He felt empowered. "Excuse me, Mr. K-Max, is it?"
K-Max squinted in what he thought was a threatening fashion. But the actual effect was to make him seem short-sighted and perhaps constipated.
"That's right, prisoner. K to the max. The king of maximum security."
"Oh, I see. A sabre K. How romantic of you."
K-Max twirled his buzz baton.
There ain't nothing romantic about me, Root. You ask my three ex-wives. I am here to cause discomfort, and that is all.
Oops, said Turnbull playfully. Sorry I spoke. This little exchange gave Visby a chance to get the shuttle out of the dock, and one of the shuttle's other occupants a moment to orientate himself and realize that his old leader was about to make his move. In fact, of the 12 rough-and-ready specimens locked down behind the shuttle security bars, 10 had served under Turnbull at one time or another, and most had done very nicely by it, until their capture. Once Visby had been reactivated, he had easily ensured that these prisoners were allocated seats.
"It will be nice for the captain to have friends around him in a time of crisis," he reasoned.
The most important friend was the sprite, Unix Blob, who sat directly across the vulcanized walkway from Turnbull. Unix was a grounded sprite, with cauterized nubs where his wings should be. Turnbull had dragged Unix out of a troll pit, and the sprite had served as his right-hand fairy ever since. He was the best kind of lieutenant, as he never questioned orders. Unix did not justify or prioritize. He was equally prepared to die, fetching Turnbull a coffee, as he was stealing a nuclear warhead. Turnbull winked at his subordinate to let him know that today was the day. Unix did not react, but then he rarely did, icy indifference being his attitude towards pretty much everything.
"Cheer up, Unix, old man," Turnbull longed to call. "Death and mayhem will shortly follow."
But he had to content himself with the wink for the moment. Visby was nervous, and it showed. The shuttle sputtered forward in lurchy hops, scraping a fender along the docking jetty.
"Nice going, Visby," snarled K-Max. "Are you trying to crush us before the probe does it?"
Visby flushed and gripped the rudder stick so tightly that his knuckles glowed green.
"It's okay. I've got it now. No problems."
The shuttle edged from the shelter of the massive curved fins that funneled the worst of the underwater currents away from the dome, and Turnbull enjoyed the receding view of New Atlantis. The cityscape was a murky jumble of traditional spires and minarets, alongside more modern glass and steel pyramids. Hundreds of slatted filter pods sat at the corners of the giant polymer pentagons that slotted together to form the protective dome over Atlantis.
"If the probe hit a filter pod, the dome could go," thought Turnbull. And then, "Oh, look, they use schoolchildren's designs to decorate the fins. How fun."
Out they went, past the water cannons, which were erect in their cradles, just waiting for coordinates.
"Farewell, my probe," thought Turnbull. "You have served me well, and I shall miss you."
A flotilla fled the threatened city. Pleasure craft and city shuttles, troop carriers and prisoner transporters, all flitting towards the 10-mile marker where the brainiacs assured them the shockwave would dissipate to the merest ripple. And though the flight seemed chaotic, it was not. Each and every craft had a marker to dock with at the 10-mile circle. Visby was growing in confidence and quickly navigated the gloomy depths towards their marker, only to find a giant squid had latched on to the pulsing buoy, pecking at its glowing beacon. The water elf turned the shuttle's exhaust on the creature, and it scooted off in a flurry of rippling tentacles. Visby let the autodock take over, luring the shuttle onto its magnetic docking buoy. K-Max laughed scornfully.
"You shouldn't shoot at your cousins, fish boy. You won't get invited to family functions."
Visby pounded the dash.
"I've had enough of you."
"Me too,"
said Turnbull, and reached out, casually pinching K-Max's buzz baton from his belt. He could have shocked the jumbo sprite immediately, but he wanted him to realize what was going on. It took a while.
"Hey,"
said K-Max.
"What are you... You just took my..."
And then the light bulb moment.
"You aren't cuffed."
"What a bright boy," said Turnbull, and thrust the buzz baton into K-Max's gut, sending 10,000 volts crackling through the pixie's body.
The guard danced on point like a possessed classical dancer, then collapsed in a boneless-looking heap.
"You shocked my fellow officer," said Visby dully, "which should upset me. But I'm okay with it. More than okay, actually, even though you can't tell by my tone of voice."
Turnbull shot Unix another wink that said,
"Watch your genius boss at work." "You don't need to feel anything, Mr. Visby. All you need to do is release bars 3 and 6.
"Just 3 and 6? Don't you want to release all your friends? You have been lonely for so long, Turnbull."
Bars 3 and 6 popped up, and Turnbull rose, luxuriously stretching his legs, as though he had been seated for an age.
Not just yet, Mr. Vishby. Some of my friends may have forgotten me.
Eunix was also freed and went immediately to work, stripping K-Max of his boots and belt. He shrugged off the top half of his own jumpsuit and tied it off at his waist, so the scar tissue of his wing nubs could get a little air. Turnbull felt a twinge of unease. Eunix was a disturbing fellow, loyal unto death, but strange beyond strange. He could have had those wing nubs carved down by a plastic doc, but he preferred to wear them like trophies.
If he ever shows the smallest sign of disloyalty, I'll have to put him down like a dog. No hesitation.
Everything all right, Eunix? The pale sprite nodded curtly, then continued to frisk K-Max's person.
Very well, said Turnbull, taking center stage for his big speech. Gentlemen, we are on the brink of what the press often refers to as an audacious prison break. Some of us will survive, and unfortunately some won't. The good news is that the choice is yours.
I choose to survive, said Ching Mail,
a gruff goblin with bite marks on his skull and muscles up to his ears.
Not so fast, Mail. A leap of faith is involved.
You can count on me, Captain.
This from Bob Ragby, a dwarf fitted with an extra restraint in the form of a mouth ring. He had fought at Turnbull's behest in many a skirmish, including the fateful one on the Turn Islands, where Julius Root and Holly Short had finally arrested him. Turnbull flicked Bob's mouth ring, making it ping.
Can I, Mr. Ragby, or has prison made you soft? Do you still have the gumption?
Just take this ring off and find out. I'll swallow that guard whole.
Oh, which guard?
Asked Vishby, nervous in spite of the thrall rune that pulsed at his throat.
Not you, Vishby, said Turnbull soothingly. Mr. Ragby didn't mean you, did you, Mr. Ragby?
Oh, I did, actually.
Turnbull's fingers flew to his mouth.
Oh, how troubling. I'm conflicted, Mr. Vishby. You've done me no little service, but Bob Ragby there wants to eat you, and that would be entertaining. Plus, he gets grumpy if we don't feed him.
Vishby wanted to be terrified, to take some radical action, but the rune on his neck forbade any emotion stronger than mild anxiety.
Please, Turnbull, Captain, I thought we were friends.
Turnbull Root considered this.
You are a traitor to your people, Vishby. How can I take a traitor for a friend?
Even a magic-doped Vishby could see the irony in this. After all, had not Turnbull Root betrayed his kind on numerous occasions, even sacrificing members of the criminal fraternity for creature comforts in his cell?
But your model parts, he objected weakly, and the computer, you gave the names of...
Turnbull did not like how this conversation was going, and so took two quick steps and buzzed Vishby in the gills. The water elf fell sideways on the pilot seat and hung in his harness, arms dangling, gills rippling.
Jabber, 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 said Turnbull brightly. All these guards are the same, always sticking it to the cons, eh, my boyos?
Eunix spun Vishby's chair round and began a thorough search, taking anything of potential use, even a small pack of indigestion tablets, because you never knew.
Here's the choice, gentlemen, said Turnbull to his captive audience. Step outside with me now, or stay and wait for an assault charge to be added to your sentence.
Just step outside,
said Bob Ragby, half-chuckling. Turnbull smiled easily, charming as a devil.
That's it, lads. We step outside into the water.
I read something about there being pressure underwater.
I heard that too,
said Ching Mail, licking an eyeball.
Won't we be crushed?
Turnbull shrugged, milking his moment.
Trust me, lads, it's all about trust. If you don't trust me, stay here and rot. I need men with me I can rely on. Especially with what I've got planned. Think of this as a test.
There were several groans. Captain Root had always had a thing for tests. It wasn't enough to be a murderous marauder. A person had to pass all these tests. Once he had made the entire group eat raw stinkworms just to prove that they were prepared to obey any order, however ludicrous. The hideaway's plumbing had taken quite a battering that weekend. Ching Mail scratched the bite marks on his crown.
Those are our choices. Stay here or step outside.
Succinctly put, Mr. Mail. Sometimes a limited vocabulary can be an advantage.
Can we think about it?
Of course. Take all the time you need, said Turnbull magnanimously. So long as your cogitations do not take more than 2 minutes.
Ching frowned.
My cogitations can take hours, especially if I have red meat.
Most fairies found animal flesh disgusting, but every enclave had its omnivorous faction.
2 minutes? Seriously, Captain? No.
Bob Rugby would have wiped his brow if he could have reached it.
Thank goodness!
It's 100 seconds now. Come on, gents. Tick-tock.
Eunix rose from his search and stood wordlessly at Turnbull's side.
That's one. Who else is willing to place their lives in my hands?
Ching nodded.
I reckon yes. You did good by me, Captain. I never even smelled fresh air till I cast my lot with you.
Count me in,
said Bob Rugby, rattling his bar.
I'm scared, Captain, I won't deny it, but I'd rather die a pirate and go back to the deeps.
Turnbull raised an eyebrow.
And?
Rugby's voice was guttural with fear.
And what, Captain? I said I'd step outside.
It's your motivation, Mr. Rugby. I need more than a reluctance to go back to prison.
Rugby banged his head on the restraining bar.
More? I want to go with you, Captain. Honest, I do, I swear it. I never met a leader like you.
Really? I don't know, you seem reluctant.
Rugby was not the sharpest spine on the hedgehog, but his gut told him that going with the captain was a lot safer than staying here. Turnbull Root was famous for dealing with evidence and witnesses in a severe fashion. There was a legend going round the fairy fugitive bars that the captain had once burned down an entire shopping complex just to get rid of a thumbprint that he may have left behind in a booth at Falafel Fabulosity.
I ain't reluctant, Captain. Tell me, please, I'm your faithful Rugby. Who was it that shot that fairy on Turnmore? It was me, good old Bob.
Turnbull wiped an imaginary tear from one eye.
Your pathetic pleadings move me, dear Bobby. Very well. Eunix, release Mr. Rugby and Ching.
The mutilated sprite did so, then popped Vishby's harness and hoisted him upright.
The turncoat, said Eunix.
Turnbull started at the sound of Eunix's reptilian voice. He realized that in all their time together, he probably hadn't heard the sprite speak more than 100 words.
No, leave him. Rice wine turns my stomach.
Other lieutenants might have requested an explanation on this point, but not Eunix, who never wanted to know stuff he didn't need to know, and even that information was ejected from his brain as soon as it outlived its usefulness. The sprite simply nodded, then tossed Vishby aside like a sack of refuse. Rugby and Ching stood quickly, as though repulsed by their seats.
I feel funny,
said the goblin, worming his little finger into one of the tooth marks on his bald skull.
Good because I'm free, but a little bad too because I might be about to die.
You never did have much of a filter between your brain and mouth, Mr. Male, moaned Turnbull. Never mind. I'm the one paid to think.
He faced the remaining prisoners.
Anybody else? 20 seconds left.
4 hands went up, 2 belonging to the same person, who was desperate not to be left behind.
Too late, said Turnbull,
and gestured for his 3 chosen acolytes to stand by him.
Come closer. We need a group hug.
Hugging was not a habit anyone who knew Turnbull Root would ever associate with him. The captain had once shot an elf for suggesting a high five, and so it was an effort for Bob and Ching to keep the shock from their faces. Even Eunix raised a jagged eyebrow.
Oh, come now, gentlemen. Am I as scary as all that?
Yes, Bob wanted to scream. You're scarier than a dwarf mum with a long-handled spoon.
But instead, he twisted his mouth into something approximating a smile and stepped into Turnbull's embrace. Eunix drew close too, as did Ching.
Aren't we the strange bunch? Said Turnbull cheerily. Honestly, Eunix, it's like hugging a plank. And you, Mr. Rugby, you really smell very bad. Has anyone ever told you that?
Rugby mumbled an admittance.
A few. Me dad, all those who were me mates.
I'm not the first, then, thank goodness. I don't mind confirming bad news, but I hate to break it.
Bob Rugby wanted to cry. For some reason, this inane chatter was terrifying. A rumble rolled through the metal skin of the shuttle. The noise grew rapidly louder until it filled the small space. From nothing to everything in 5 seconds.
2 minutes are up, shouted Turnbull. Time for the faithful to go outside.
The hull above the small group's heads glowed red suddenly, as something melted it from the outside. Several alarms pulsed into life on the viewscreen's heads-up display.
Wow! Shouted Turnbull. Total chaos all of a sudden! What could be going on?
The section overhead was molten now, and it should have dripped down onto the group, searing their flesh. But somehow it was siphoned off. Blob by white-hot blob, a large circle of the roof was sucked away until there was nothing holding the sea out except some kind of gel.
"Should we hold our breath?"
asked Bob Ragby, trying not to sob.
"Not much point, really,"
answered Turnbull, who loved toying with people.
"It's nice to know more than everybody else," he thought.
Then four Amorphobots, who had merged into one large gelatinous blob, dropped a fat tentacle into the shuttle's interior and sucked up Captain Root and his gang, clean as a dwarf sucking a snail from its shell. 1 second they were there, and the next nothing remained but a slight smear on the deck and the echo of slobbering slurp.
"I'm so glad I stayed where I am,"
said one of the remaining prisoners, who had never served with Turnbull. He had, in fact, earned his 6-year sentence for making clever copies of collectible cartoon character spoons.
"That blobby thing looked creepy."
None of the others spoke, as they had immediately realized what catastrophe would result from the blobby thing breaking its seal round the large hole in the hull. As it happened, the expected catastrophe never got a chance to occur, because as soon as the Amorphobots vacated the space, the hole was filled by the rogue probe, which had deviated suddenly from its course to plough through the shuttle, bearing it deep into the bedrock of the ocean floor, mashing it completely. As for the people inside the shuttle, they were mostly liquefied. It would be months before any remains were found, and even longer before those remains could be identified. The impact crater was more than 15 meters deep, and at least the same across. The whiplash shock rippled across the seabed, decimating the local ecology, and stacking half a dozen rescue crafts on top of each other like building blocks. The giant Amorphoblob bore Turnbull and his cohorts swiftly from the impact site, perfectly mimicking the motion of a giant squid, even sprouting gelticles, which funneled the water in a tight cone behind it. Inside the main body of gel, two fairies were perfectly calm. Turnbull could fairly be called serene, and Unix was as unperturbed by this latest marvel as he was by anything that he had seen in his long life. Bob Ragby, on the other hand, could in truth be called terrified out of his tiny mind. While Turnbull had summoned the Amorphobots and had a fair idea of what to expect, as far as Ragby was concerned, they had been swallowed by a jelly monster and were being carried off to its lair to be consumed during the long cold winter. All Ching Mail could think was one sentence over and over again.
"I'm sorry I stole the candy cane."
Which more than likely referred to an incident that was significant to him and to whomever he'd stolen the candy cane from. Turnbull reached into the jumble of electronics in the Amorphobot's belly and pulled out a small cordless mask, which he slipped over his face. It was possible to speak through the gel, but the mask made it infinitely easier.
"Well, my brave lads, we are now officially dead and free to take a shot at stealing LEP's most powerful natural resource, something truly magical."
Ching snapped out of his candy cane loop. He opened his mouth to speak, but realized quickly that while the gel somehow fed oxygen to his lungs, it didn't support speech so well without a mask. He gargled for a moment, then decided to pose his question later.
"I can guess what you were about to say, Mr. Mayo," said Turnbull. "Why in heavens would we want to tangle with the LEP? Surely we should stay as far away from the police as possible."
An amber light in the belly of the bot cast sinister shadows across the captain's face.
"I say no. I say we attack now and steal what we need from right under their noses. And while we're about it, spread a little destruction and mayhem to cover our tracks. You have seen what I can do from a prison cell. Imagine what might be possible from the freedom of the wide world."
It was difficult to argue with this point, especially when the fairy making the point controlled the gel robot thing that was keeping everyone alive, and no one else knew if they could speak or not. Turnbull Root always knew how to pick his moment. The Amorphobot dropped quickly behind a jagged reef, escaping the worst of the shockwave. Slivers of rock and lumps of coral tumbled down through the murky water, but were rejected by the gel. A squid ventured too close and was treated to a lick with an electrified gelticle. And as the walls of a towering undersea cliff flashed by in stripes of grey and green, Turnbull sighed into his mask, the sound amplified and distorted.
"I am coming, my love," he thought. "Soon we will be together."
He decided against saying this aloud, as even Unix might think it a little melodramatic. Turnbull realized with a jolt that he was completely happy. and the cost of that happiness bothered him not a jot.